the UCR Podcast.
Well, as music fans and fans of hard rock and heavy metal, we all got, as my guest today said, as we were getting ready for this conversation, a big gut punch yesterday when we heard the news that Ozzy Osbourne is gone at the age of 76. And so, like a lot of fans, I have spent the past period of hours just trying to get my head around just what Ozzy Osbourne meant to me as a music fan and just everything that this guy was. And for everybody that's hearing this right now, you know that's kind of a complicated thing, because it's like the more you start to think about it as fans, like the memories that we have wrapped up in these songs and albums, like a lot of stuff starts to come out. The shows that you went to with friends, all sorts of stuff. So this guy has truly been a soundtrack in a lot of ways for us as music fans, and just a huge part on many different levels when it comes to pop culture. So we're going to get into this. I'm happy that UCR's Gary Graff can join us today to talk some Ozzy. And, you know, Gary, one of the things that I thought about, and this is kind of what triggered me reaching out to you, was back around late 90s when Ozfest first started going, I was working for WMMS here in Cleveland. And of course, like every year, like we would be out at Blossom Music Center for Ozfest. And every year we would have like an interview with Ozzy or somebody in the green room, you know, backstage and all that kind of stuff. So for years, like I have thought about the interview that we had like around 98 or 99 or so with Ozzy, where Ozzy at this point, I think we were already looking at Ozzy as being kind of feeble, or at the very least fragile. And I can remember him coming out, because he was interviewing with our morning person at the time, and he comes walking out in kind of a fragile kind of way. I think he had a cane. He was taking these tentative steps. He takes about three or four steps into the room and all of a sudden throws the cane to the side and like runs across the room and jumps into this woman's arms. And all of us were like, holy crap. Like, it just was something that you didn't expect Ozzy to do. So it's just like Ozzy was always kind of doing this stuff in public, you know, before an interview, during an interview, after an interview, or, you know, behind closed doors. Like, he truly was just this unbelievable personality that, like, we've only seen one of this guy. This guy was a one of one. So it's just like, I'm so curious to hear some of your Ozzy stories and, you know, what some of your initial encounters with Ozzy were like. But I think where we should start, Gary, is like, obviously, like, what are your memories, I guess, of coming across the music of Ozzy and Sabbath for the first time? Like, how did that happen for you as a music fan?
Yeah, I mean, being a man of a certain age, it was Sabbath first.
Yeah.
And early on, thanks to having an older brother old enough, that those first albums were in my orbit. It's funny, he wasn't a fan, but by virtue of having turned me on to Steppenwolf and Born to Be Wild, gave 7-8-year-old me a taste for the hard that then became Led Zeppelin in real time, Black Sabbath in real time, and listening to that first Black Sabbath album, like so many people talk about. I remember being at covering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction in October and being back there talking to Maynard and talking to Billy Idol. And all of us had this weird same experience with that first Black Sabbath album, that what the hell is this? This is scary. You know, this is genuinely frightening. And that voice, I mean, it's a freaking banshee. That's not a singer. And it just, and I remember, you know, feeling the same way hearing Geddy Lee for the first time on the first Rush album, this otherworldly vocal quality, and feeling like, okay, this is a creature. This is not a singer. This is something else, and therefore something completely original. You know, I couldn't have told you back then this would be the only one we'd hear like this, but it just came. It came out of nowhere and just hit you like that. And everything hit you, of course. The detuned guitar, the doomy, you know, the Exorcist on record type of vibe that the whole thing had. So that was, you know, that was the beginning for me, and stayed with them and him and the rest of them, you know, all the way through up until back to the beginning, just, you know, 18 days ago now.
Yeah, the Rush thing's a really good comparison, because it's just like, I think that, you know, for musicians, like some musicians had their Kiss records, and that was a whole jumping off point that was influential for them. And then for a whole other batch of musicians, it was Sabbath records. And it's like, I like that you brought up Rush, because as you kind of just laid out when you started talking about Sabbath instrumentally, it's like those are two bands that there is that common ground to where they were like doing a thing that collectively and individually, like they were creating a collective sound that they had never, that music fans really had never heard. And I think that's why that, like, you know, more than 50 years later, it's like you go back, as you and I did here in recent weeks, especially, and even recent months, as we were leading up to the Back to the Beginning tribute, when you go back and listen to those Sabbath records, like they still are in a class all their own, where it's just like, the recording, the sound, like they are just fascinating albums to unpack. And I know that I had a music fan friend slash writer that mentioned this pretty quickly after Back to the Beginning wrapped up. And he just noted that basically all the bands outside of like the all-star bands that Tom Morello put together, basically all the bands outside of those all-star bands largely covered Sabbath, you know? So it just kind of, it kind of showed the impact that those Sabbath records have had. Like there are a lot of bands, and you've seen this, Gary, when it's like, when somebody does a tribute show like this, they go to like the obvious cuts from a band to cover. Like these guys on the day at Back to the Beginning, they were picking the deep cuts. Like it was impressive. The songs that, like, you know, that Guns N' Roses and, you know, okay, Alice in Chains, Fairies Wear Boots. That's you know, that's kind of a Sabbath classic,
it's,
even though it's not
top of the B list.
Yeah, kind
of.
Correct.
Yeah, it's the top of the second batch.
But it's like Metallica, Johnny Blade. Like, I mean, there were some really impressive picks. And I think that like the songs that the bands were picking for Back to the Beginning showed just like the deep rooted impact that Ozzy and Sabbath had and still has with all these people.
We all listened to the albums. Okay, yeah. It wasn't just listening to Paranoid and, you know, Iron Man and War Pigs and Children of the Grave and the A-list. If you got a Black Sabbath album, you listened front to back, especially those first five or six. You know, you cared about all the songs on them. You know, clear, without a doubt.
In our obituary for Ozzy, among his many achievements, we labeled him as the co-creator of heavy metal. And that is like certainly not hype, I think, as we've been talking about here, just with like the pieces and parts of Sabbath and how that all combined to be this thing that just had a huge influence on musicians. But like from your perspective, like what are kind of the things that you hear now, if you think about it, like as far as like how Ozzy and Sabbath, you know, changed music?
Well, I mean, even just look at the various, well, look at Back to the Beginning or look at the various Ozfest lineups. And, you know, James Hetfield came out and said it, as many did, there wouldn't have been a Metallica without Ozzy and Black Sabbath. There would not, you know, there would not have been a Disturbed, a Slayer, a Slipknot, a Megadeth. And if we start this, you and I will be here a lot longer than we have time for. But all those bands on, any band that calls itself metal is a child of Black Sabbath, whether directly or indirectly. You know, there are, at this point, there are second, third, maybe even fourth generation, you know, bands, or bands, you know, three, four generations removed that, you know, made their way back to Sabbath and Ozzy at some point, just because that's what you do if you're going to call yourself metal. If I ever had a metal musician say to me in an interview they don't know much about Black Sabbath, I would get ready to hang up, but say, before I hang up on you, let's talk after you've heard this, and this. Because that's it. There was heavy music before Black Sabbath, without a doubt. Not too long before Black Sabbath, but there was heavy music, but it wasn't metal. Yeah. You know, and Black Sabbath is really what put what we came to call metal into the music, and coming from that place like Birmingham, you know, which was, that's a blue collar metal kind of city. So it was in their DNA. They were inventive and creative to find it, but it wasn't a stretch, nor was it a stretch for Judas Priest coming out of there. The greater stretch was, how does Duran Duran come out of Birmingham and sound like
that? If we talk about that, we'll be here all day.
Exactly. Point. But it was, Sabbath really did find the metal in the heavy music. And that's, and you can't overstate the importance of that or the influence of that. You just can't. It was that important. I think, NBC led the nightly news last night.
Wow.
With 4 minutes on Ozzy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's NBC freaking news.
Yeah.
And, I haven't looked at a lot of print editions. I'm sure it was front page in the New York Times and things like that. And yes, that's how important they are. He was and he is and will be.
Yes, New York Times had, I know that at the very least, like within the hours after the news of the death broke, it's like they had Ozzy Osbourne's Essential 12 Songs. Yeah, you don't see that for everybody from the New York Times. No. But I do. I want to go back to what you said about Birmingham, though, because that's something I was thinking about, was just the idea that, like, really Judas Priest and Black Sabbath, like, they both kind of came from the same water. But isn't it really interesting, like, how they both kind of channeled similar things? And there are similarities there, but they are two distinctly different bands. But it's just like, we got two of the major heavyweights of heavy metal right there from Birmingham. And it's like, and the DNA that is common to both of them is very interesting. That's why I think it's great that, KK Downing was there, because, like, I think you might have spoken to KK, but it's just like all the interviews that KK did leading up to Back to the Beginning, like he talked about, and he has talked about prior to that, just how important those guys were to them, how much they meant to the Judas Priest guys. It's just like there, that Birmingham was and is small enough that, like, these guys knew each other and found common ground quickly, because it's like they were mates, and it's like they were there to help each other in a sense, because it's like they both understood where they came from.
Well, a small society, like you say, and also an even smaller music community that they were working within, the heavy bands like that. So you couldn't avoid each other like that. Clearly you were going to influence each other. And I think Sabbath, having gotten the label deal that they did in front of Priest, was certainly, and KK's told me this, Rob Halford has told me this, some of the other guys, seeing Sabbath get that told Priest that they could do it too.
Yeah,
that was incredibly inspirational for them, even though, again, as you noted, they took their own kind of path with the music.
I don't know if it happens as much in, like, say, New York or Los Angeles, any other city you want to name, but certainly, like, to use something we're both very familiar with, Detroit's a good example of, there have been a lot of bands, obviously, that have come out of Detroit, but you said something very important. Like, it is very important when you're in, like, a city like Detroit, for example, when you see a band that does it, that gets the label deal or whatever, it's just like, there's obviously a long, rich music scene that was built off of the first few bands that did that back in the day. But back in the day, when that first happened, and anytime that happens in a particular, state, city, that's kind of the marker that shows you that, like, what we're doing as a band, this is not wasted time. This can go somewhere. And so it's like, it's interesting to think that that happens even in somewhere like Birmingham with Black Sabbath and Judas Priest. But there you go. It's like there's a small town or a music scene somewhere, everywhere, where it's like bands, even if they end up being the legends that we know them to be today, they're all having these same experiences where they're inspired by the scene and what's going on with the scene.
Absolutely. And again, Birmingham being rock and roll being a smaller community back in 68, 69, when those bands were getting together too, and then being a subset of what was rock and roll then, perfect kind of matchup, to have happened. And there were others that came out of, the north of England, these industrial cities, where it was very blue collar and an appreciation for the raw. And the economics played into that too. They couldn't necessarily afford the gear to make them sound polished. So they made the best with the gear that they could, and it was going to sound raw. And they were, and if you're going to sound raw, I do think you're going to sound heavy. And even if you're an acoustic folk act, you're going to, there's going to be a kind of heaviness if you're raw. And that definitely was what happened, you know, with, not in the folk side, but on the rock side with Sabbath and Priest. And, you know, they couldn't afford the gear to make them polished. So they went with the raw and it became very heavy.
Yeah. You mentioned Ozzfest, and of course, we cannot talk about Ozzy Osbourne without Ozzfest. I like the idea that Ozzfest basically comes out of the fact that Ozzy is being excluded from Lollapalooza. So Sharon basically says, that's fine. We'll make our own thing.
And it's like,
and, you know, after those initial couple of shows, I think in California in 96, like, what a big play to roll out in 97, where it's like, you know, the bill is just staggering. But the fact that the bill, you know, basically has, you know, Ozzy and Sabbath doing separate sets as the headliners to wrap up the night, like, that's about the biggest flex that you can possibly make in year one. What kind of sticks with you? Like, this was another thing that made me think about talking about all this, was just like, as we were talking, you know, last year about the 90s book, we were talking about Ozzfest and how you would like go to Ozzfest and you would carry like a coffin like contraption with you that you use to file your stories, and like, just how perfect to be filing, as we discussed at the time, how perfect to be filing stories using a coffin like apparatus for Ozzy Osbourne and apparatus. So perfect. But yeah, so what are kind of, I guess, some of your Ozzfest memories that stick with you?
Well, the water, certainly, because the water cannon. In fact, back then I did a magazine feature about the water cannon, because that was such a big part of it. Started with a bucket, but then it became a cannon. And this thing was a high pressure gun.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, that he used from there. But it was a fixture in every show, overused, certainly if you were in the line of fire. But usually Ozzfest was on a very hot day, so you'd be dried off by the next time he fired at you. So I definitely always remember that. You know, I remember, too, just walking around looking at these people dressed for metal on a 95-degree sunny day. You know, metal doesn't do, like, gym shorts real well.
No.
You know, it,
and they,
you
also
know,
normally don't do 10 a.m., but they were showing up at 10 a.m. for that Ozzfest start.
Because you had,
like,
you had
like great, a religion.
Yeah. You had great acts on the second stage. I mean, first time I saw Slipknot, second stage Ozzfest, Disturbed, Trapped, you know, what was Jada Pinkett Smith's band?
Oh, yeah, Wicked Wisdom.
Yeah, they played Ozzfest on the second stage with, at our date, at least, Will Smith bopping around in the crowd.
Sure.
And watching her play. So, you know, they gave you a reason to be there early and then to stay all day, because you were going to get Ozzy, and on some years Sabbath. And if not Sabbath, there'd be a Slayer or a Judas Priest to finish the day. I had this, you talked about the backstage interview earlier and Ozzy dropping the cane and leaping into the Air Personality's arms. I had one occasion where they had the media tent backstage, which always surprised me that they would put the media tent in that proximity. And almost nobody, you know, it wasn't much of a deal. There was a table. I don't think there were even chairs, and occasionally there was water. But I remember Ozzy just kind of coming out and floating around, and he picks up a jump rope. And he starts jumping rope as Ozzy Osbourne would jump, as you'd imagine him jumping rope. You know, he was not crossing arms and doing, you know, whap, you know, tornado like repetitions, but he was just kind of doing his thing and looking and thinking, huh, Ozzy Osbourne jumping rope, not on my bingo card. And there he is, getting himself ready for the show. But the exuberance always, regardless of what shape he was in, you know, when he came out, the happiest guy in the place was Ozzy Osbourne.
100%. Yeah.
You know, even more than any of the fans. I mean, this was his thing. This was his home. There's a reason why a lot of the support acts on Ozzfest called him dad and called Sharon mom. It wasn't just Zakk Wylde who did that there. You know, it was just always like, you know, like that, because they really, there was an esprit de corps amidst the competition that was fostered, that in fact Sharon insisted upon. And of course, she insisted upon a degree of homage to Ozzy, you know, at least respect. You know, you respect him as the godfather.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because it's just like you look at Ozfest now, and there's a couple things that I've been thinking about. Like, one, I think you kind of started to take for granted that you were going to get to see Ozzy every year. Like, it's like, as I was looking back at the lineups this morning, it's just like, there's Ozzy just year after year for a period of years. And it's just like, that's another thing when you talk about a legend like Ozzy Osbourne. It's just like, you didn't normally get a chance to see these guys every summer. Now, I think, you know, we kind of just imagine the way things are now. It's like every band and artist seems to go out every year. But back then, it's like we were more used to some of these guys, you know, going out touring for 2 years at a time and then going away for 2 or 3 years. And so it's just like, it really kind of was like a luxury that I think some people took for granted, that it's like you had Ozzy out there every summer. And the other thing is, like, you've kind of talked about this, just mentioning all the bands that were on the bill, but it's just like, when you look at some of these bands now, it's like, I think that they're, well, just quite simply, when you look at some of these bills now, it's like, it's pretty incredible, because these are now some of these bands that are now megastars themselves, that are playing arenas and sheds or whatever they're doing, that, as you say, like, they were starting out playing the second stage back in the day. But, you know, so the lineup looks a little bit different now, looking at, say, like 97 and 98. Than it did looking at it at the time in 97, 98, where you're going, okay, I know this band, this band, and this band. And to be fair, as a guy that was hosting a heavy metal show, I knew a lot of the bands because I was playing them. So I was, I had more familiarity than some folks might have going out. But even still, they were new bands. So it's just so it just kind of, I think, really, for the criticism, my general point is that for the criticism that was sometimes levied at Sharon and Ozzy Inc. at the time for maybe how they were booking the fest, the people knew what they were doing. And it's like time has told that story now when we look at these lineups, that like these bills were not just thrown together. There actually was some thought and curation. And I certainly saw that, as you did, attending these things. And it's like you can really see that now looking at the lineups, like just how hard they worked to put together a lineup that would be a good day for fans of hard rock and heavy metal to enjoy.
And so crucial to the artists and to the scene, Ozfest became a benediction for any band that was on it. It would have been instant attention from radio programmers, from press people, certainly in the heavy press, but I think in the mainstream rock scene as well. But if this was a band worthy of being on Ozfest, it was worthy of at least a cursory look. And then from there, you know, so many of them did become headliners in their own right. And, there was a lot of booking genius. I think there was a combination of, and I remember from reporting on it at the time, combination of gut instinct and the idea that, look, if you put this band on Ozfest, here's what we will do as a record label, as a booking agency. Here's the support we'll give to our band, which will be support for your tour as well.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Well, last couple things, because it's a busy day for everybody. But, I guess the last couple things I want to hear about are kind of your favorite Ozzy concert experience, and then perhaps favorite interview experience.
Yeah, the interview experiences were, you know, Lord, give me subtitles. I took to recording them and slowing them down when I played them back. I mean, there's that famous, I forget which, was it a coffee or a juice chain commercial that they had Ozzy, you know, the guy couldn't understand Ozzy and he had to text him the order. That's what talking to him was like, in person or on the phone. And, you know, you really had to pay attention to what was going on, but he always had something interesting to say and good to say. I mean, a very self-aware guy. And, I remember him talking about knowing what Ozzy Osbourne was, that Ozzy was kind of, you know, like Alice Cooper will tell you too, Ozzy was Halloween, or mm-hmm. Ozzy was burlesque. Ozzy was old-time showmanship. Is everybody happy? You know, and get everybody going like that. And he knew that. And he knew what he was playing to. So it was always very pleasant, if a little maddening, talking to him, just because of that. You hate to call it a language barrier, because we were ostensibly speaking the same language. But you know, you really did have to sift through there and remember.
You're not alone, because certainly UCR's Michael Gallucci, I pulled this up on Facebook. He posted after Ozzy passed yesterday. He said, I interviewed Ozzy Osbourne years ago. I understood maybe every 20th word he said, including all the variations of fuck. It's one of my all-time favorite interviews. You know, so like, and now it's like we can dump an interview into, you know, the computer and, you know, keyboard hotkeys, fast forward, rewind, fast forward, rewind. I'm not even talking about dumping it into something to like automatically give you like a rough initial transcribe. But back then, Gary, I know you're pained, because you're talking about sitting there with a cassette, rewinding and fast forwarding and slowing it down, just trying to get that one damn word. What was it that they said? And that's the same for Ozzy. That could be the same for any member of the Scorpions. It was a thing.
Scorpions, I found the Scorpions' diction was a little better. As people with English as a second language.
Yeah.
You know, Ozzy's version of English was his first language. you know, a combination of Brummy and unfortunately damage, you know, that happened. But and in terms of the concerts, a lot of great Ozfest memories. I did it. I always enjoyed the Sabbath gigs best, I gotta say. It was Sabbath. I mean, you know, it was so as good as Zach, you know, Wild was, as good as all the other guitar players he worked with were. You know, there's nothing like hearing him sing with Tony and Geezer, and when it was Bill Ward or when it was Tommy Clufetos, you know, those guys behind him. And again, I think that comes with, what age were you? Where was your portal, you know, to this music? And if you came in with Sabbath at the beginning, you were going to like, you know, those Sabbath shows were probably going to stick with you, you know, maybe more than the Ozzy shows. And I think Sabbath made Ozzy always a hard worker. And I'm not going to imply that he wasn't on his own, you know, not by a long stretch. But I think being with those guys made him hunker down more and concentrate more and work a little harder. And maybe, I mean, he spent a lifetime being somewhat scared of Tony Iommi, and that translated, you know, from their youth, and that translated into standing on stage next to Tony and the kind of performer Ozzy wanted to be when it was Sabin. And again, that's not at all to disparage those solo shows. I saw a lot of really fun Ozzy solo shows, but I saw transcendent Black Sabbath shows.
Yeah, that's not disparaging at all. Like, you made me think of two things. One, it's like, as we know, it's like, you know, watching that Sabbath set, like, you can see how these guys feed off of each other. And Geezer Butler was just unbelievable. That guy looked tour ready. But it's just like, also a big reminder that I got, like, is with the Ozzy solo set is like, you know, you mentioned Zach, you know, so it's always cool to see him up there playing with Zach Wild, but it's just like kind of one of those like baseball card. We always call them like classic rock baseball card kind of moments. Collect the ball. One of those moments for me that I had not seen in a long time that was cool to see again, that I did not think about the fact that I was going to get to see it, was seeing Mike Inez back up there on stage with Ozzy. So it's just like Ozzy, there was a lot of thought, you know, because he had played with Sabbath. Like, he knew that he couldn't just go out and, you know, just get a bunch of scrubs to play in his solo band. That started from like moment one. Moment one, right. You know, when he puts out the first solo record, like, he always had a killer band. And it's like, so I think that's something that, like, if you look back at the various people that played with him over the years, whether it's a Mike Inez, you know, guys like Jake E. Lee, you know, and so on and on and on and on, like, they had some incredible players in that lineup. And so, you know, I think that's one thing that I appreciate a lot of things about the whole Back to the Beginning thing. Of course, top of the list being that Ozzy got to do this and got to see how much he was appreciated by, you know, not only the fans, but all of his musicians and peers before he's gone. I'm so glad that he got to do that. But it's just like, I also think that, like, throughout that long day of music as fans, like, we got to see a lot of really cool things. Be it Jake E. Lee playing, you know, Ozzy songs again, be it Mike Inez on stage with Ozzy, you know, the Sabbath set, of course, and on and on and on. Like, it's so weird. Like, after the day was done, Gary, like, a lot of people started making comparisons to the Freddie Mercury tribute. So it's just kind of cool that Ozzy's version of the Freddie Mercury tribute happened while he was still here.
And he, yes, that definitely, that he got to see it, and that we got it,
yeah,
too. I mean, that was a gift. That really was a gift to the fans as well, because, you know, going back to the bingo card thing, Ozzy reaching 76, probably not on a lot of our bingo cards.
No.
You know, I think Ozzy reaching 30 maybe wasn't on bingo cards back then, so that he got to do that, that he got to sound as good as he did. I remember I spoke with Sharon before, and she told me he'd been working with a vocal coach, and you could tell this mattered to him. Everything, of course, mattered, but this really mattered to him to be good on that day and to go out on the note he did. And how many artists get to do that? You know, we think about Brian Wilson, who we also lost this year. And I was at his last concert, which was here in Detroit. And it's something we don't want to remember.
We really don't. We've all
now,
seen those hard last shows or farewell tours that just were not good. This was a good out.
He was lifting the Stanley Cup, the World Series trophy, the Super Bowl trophy, and the NBA trophy and the NCAA trophy all at the same time. Going out on that note, it's a rare gift, and like I said, it was a gift to us as much as to him.
Yeah, well, Gary, thank you, man. I wish we were talking about Ozzy under different circumstances, but I'm glad we could have this conversation.
Better things next time.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.